Hello and welcome to WaveScan, the international DX program from Adventist World Radio. Researched and written in Indianapolis by Dr. Adrian Peterson and in Los Angeles by Ray Robinson, and produced in the studios of WRMI Shortwave in Okeechobee, Florida. I'm Jeff White. This is edition NWS 813 for release on Sunday, September 22nd, 2024. On the program today, AFN News in Times of Tragedy and Trends in Shortwave Programming by Fred Waterer. A few weeks back at the beginning of August, we brought you the story of the early beginnings of AFN in Europe. Perhaps as portrayed in the movie Good Morning Vietnam, there's been a general misconception that news carried on the American Forces Network or other AFRTS services was subject to government censorship. While that may have been the case in the active theater of war in which AFVN operated, it has not been the case with AFN since the end of World War II. However, AFN certainly had its challenges with news coverage in times of tragedy, and Ray Robinson again brings us a story about this, which was first published in AFN's Silver Jubilee magazine in 1968.
Thanks, Jeff. At 19:34 hours local time on the evening of the 22nd of November 1963, a short one-sentence news item clacked out of a teletype machine in the AFN studios in Frankfurt, Germany. Quote, Dallas, November 22nd, UPI. Three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade today in downtown Dallas. Unquote. And thus quietly began one of the biggest programming challenges of AFN's 25-year history. Up until that moment, this had been a normal day at AFN. In fact, it had been unusually quiet on the news scene. The president's visit to Texas had been getting quite a bit of play on the newscasts, mainly because there wasn't much else to report. The biggest activity of that day had little to do with the broadcasting routine. The program directors from around the network were in Frankfurt for a conference. Chief of Program Operations, Don Brewer, was giving a big dinner party at the Terrace Club in honor of the program directors. Cocktails were being served at 19:34 hours. Station Commander, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Cranston, had spent the day in Heidelberg meeting with his superiors. He was still there at 19:34 hours. At the studios, MSG Lloyd Eyre was presenting the program Music in the Air, an hour of uninterrupted dinner music. The newsroom was lightly staffed. Work was soon to begin on the big 2200 newscast, but most of the staffers were still at supper. European editor and later news director David Minat was in a neighbouring office making final preparations for the programme Report from Europe. It was to be aired right after Music in the Air at 2000 hours, calling in AFN correspondents from around Europe. SP4 John Grimaldi was keeping an eye on the teletypes. Grimaldi noticed the item from Dallas almost immediately. He was very interested, but quite rightly did not push the panic button. The story didn't say anybody had been hit by the shots, and it was nearly half an hour until the next news broadcast. The best thing to do was stand by the machine and watch for further developments. The bells on the machine clanged at 19:39, and Grimaldi saw it rap out the stunning news. He stiffened in disbelief. Quote, flash, flash, Kennedy seriously wounded, perhaps fatally, by assassin's bullet. Unquote. Grimaldi tore off the copy and ran to Minot, who was on the telephone to an engineer in France. Kennedy's been shot. Oh, come on, said Minot. The man in France agreed it was a joke. But one look at the copy, though, and Minot's jocular mood changed. Without another thought, he ran down the corridor to the studio and told Eyre to put him on the air. AFN listeners got the news at 19:41. As it later developed, this was 11 minutes after the assassination and less than 2 minutes after the flash had been received in the AFN newsroom. Music in the air faded, and Minot's voice came on steadily as he said, Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this program for a special news bulletin. President Kennedy, on a visit to Dallas, Texas, has been reportedly seriously wounded, perhaps fatally. Then his voice broke with emotion as he said, "We'll have more as soon as it's received here at AFN." Eyre's voice displayed no emotion at all as he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we continue with the programme in progress." And then music in the air resumed. There was a strict rule at AFN that only the programme director or his deputy could authorise the interruption of a programme for a news bulletin. Minat knew perfectly well that he was violating this rule. The news spread rapidly through the building. Somebody heard it on the monitor down in the lunchroom and spread the alarm. Newsmen left their food on the table and dashed upstairs. Somebody tried to get hold of programme director Brewer at the Terrace Club, but it was no easy job. First you had to wait for them to answer at the club office. Then somebody had to check which of several parties was AFN's. Then he had to go there and try to find Brewer, whom he didn't know. It took agonising minutes. Another bulletin moved on the teletype, giving more details. Minot grabbed it and made a second unauthorised seizure of the airwaves. "Again, we interrupt this programme with more word on what has happened in Texas. President Kennedy and Governor John B. Connally of Texas were cut down by an assassin's bullet as they toured downtown Dallas in an open automobile. Mrs. Kennedy is reported to have jumped up and grabbed Mr. Kennedy. She cried, 'Oh no!' and then the motorcade sped on." Somebody heard the report in Heidelberg and relayed the word to Colonel Cranston. He tried to get through to the station on the telephone. When Music in the Air signed off at 2000 hours, these two bulletins were all that had been put on the air. The next regularly scheduled programme was a newscast, Report from Europe, reporting on European events of the day. Minat, with nothing else prepared, went through with this scheduled newscast, but including more brief special bulletins as they were received. Between those special bulletins, unfortunately, listeners heard the workaday news of European politics, which must have seemed rather irrelevant at the time. Report from Europe signed off at 2015. By that time, Brewer had been reached at the Terrace Club and the party had instantly dissolved. He and all the other officials of the network headed back to the studios. Brewer gave the order on the phone that all normal programming was to be suspended until the story was wrapped up. At 2015, AFN switched to a format of music and bulletins, but it only lasted about 5 minutes. Minat immediately checked and found that the Armed Forces Radio and Television Service, AFRTS, was picking up and transmitting by shortwave a CBS report direct from Dallas. It was put on the air. And so it was, at about 2025, AFN listeners got the first definite news the president was dead. The voice of newsman Alan Jackson was slow and grave as he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States is dead. John F. Kennedy died of wounds received in assassination in Dallas less than an hour ago. We repeat, it has just been announced that President Kennedy is dead." By now, after many frustrating delays, Colonel Cranston had finally gotten through to the network from Heidelberg. He gave two orders. One, start arranging immediately for cable connections to the US, and two, make arrangements to keep the station on the air all night. He was on his way back and would be there in an hour. The Atlantic cable was engaged with a minimum of delay. This was fortunate because shortwave reception was not good that night. It was all right during the first few minutes of its use, but it deteriorated rapidly after that to below broadcast quality. The network remained on the air through a long, active night. Outstations were instructed to remain with the network until further notice. Off-duty announcers and engineers were tracked down and told to come in for extra shifts. In the days that followed, the staff did an excellent job. The backbone of the operation was the network coverage from the States. AFRTS switched from one network to another, presenting whichever it thought was producing the most interesting coverage at the moment. And thanks to the Atlantic cable, listeners heard it as clearly as though they'd been in their living rooms back in the USA. During the next 4 days, AFN listeners heard interviews with assassination witnesses and with the police after the arrest of Lee Harvey Oswald. They heard reports of the return to Washington of the coffin, the swearing-in of Lyndon B. Johnson as president, and the new president's request for your help and God's. AFN was carrying a live report of Oswald's prison transfer when he was shot down by Jack Ruby before the astonished eyes of the announcer. Finally, the network carried the full drama of the funeral. This Washington observance was one of the first live television events to be relayed to Europe via satellite. Many Americans watched the event on German or French TV, but alongside AFN radio providing a commentary in English. In 1963, the Atlantic cable cost $4 a minute, and the network stayed with it for 4 days. Round-the-clock coverage ceased after the funeral, but AFN programming was subdued for weeks afterwards. Christmas programming was introduced about the middle of December, and then after the holidays, the network returned fully to normal. There were other tragic events that AFN covered, such as the second Kennedy assassination in June 1968, and at all times the network endeavoured to bring the news to its listeners fast and factual, without any government intervention of censorship in any way. Back to you, Jeff.
Thanks, Ray, for that fascinating look at AFN in a time of crisis coverage. Next week, Ray will begin a two-part series looking at the early radio scene in the island nation of Japan. A few weeks back, we had the first part of Fred Waterer's presentation at the 2024 NASB annual meeting in Ontario, Canada, about trends in shortwave programming and shortwave radio in general. Today, let's continue with Fred's interesting remarks, which I read at the meeting, because Fred became ill at the last moment and was unable to attend in person. If anything, I bring to the table over 4 decades of enthusiastic listening and curious observation. If you'll permit me, I'd like to give you a few observations comparing the past to the present. The 1970s and 1980s were all about the battle for hearts and minds between East and West. Eavesdropping on the Cold War led to hours and hours of listening every week. Countries on both sides of the political divide would entice listeners with musical, cultural, and entertainment programming designed to keep us listening to their more political offerings. At the time, we rolled our eyes at the propaganda, presented with varying degrees of intensity, from the professionalism of Moscow to the strident Stalinism of Albania. QSL chasers and people in regular correspondence with stations would wind up with tons of mail. I have the filing cabinets full of printed materials to prove it. Shortwave radio was a window onto trends in the world. When I began listening in 1978, it was an era of détente. Broadcasts from the Soviet Union and its satellites reflected this. By about 1981, the Cold War was back in full force and would be for several years. In 1985-86, Gorbachev appeared on the scene, and again the tone started to change. 1989 brought Tiananmen Square and some really compelling radio. And then, in the course of about 6 to 7 weeks, communist parties all over the East Bloc fell from power. When the Cold War ended, an interesting thing happened. If I recall correctly, Radio Budapest in Hungary was one of, if not the first national broadcaster to leave shortwave. Without the Cold War and the Iron Curtain, there was no longer the need to capture hearts and minds. Many international broadcasters cut back some or all of their shortwave output. As a listener, I found this frustrating because now that really interesting things were going on, one could not hear programs about it. It's no secret that many state broadcasters have left the airwaves, or are a shadow of themselves. Some countries like Canada cut their international broadcasts to save money or protect jobs in domestic networks. It's hard to cut popular domestic programs which might upset the voters. Cutting external services is less painful politically at the expense of soft diplomacy. And a bit short-sighted, but that might be my inner hobbyist speaking. Budget cuts have also impacted shortwave broadcasting, not to mention the cost of energy. There are a certain number of organizations that have decided that the Internet is the way to go. I've always thought the Internet was an excellent accompaniment to shortwave radio, but not necessarily a replacement. Again, that may be a bit naive on my part and my inner hobbyist poking through. Is shortwave still alive? I keep reading in places that it's dead or dying. I think it has changed, but that it is far from dead and indeed could be useful in many ways going forward. So, after taking a bit of a meander, and I appreciate your patience, these are the trends I see in shortwave programming and where we're going. If you haven't already noticed, I'm a glass-half-full guy most of the time. As mentioned already, state broadcasters have left the scene in many, but not all cases. One can hear, for example, Radio Romania International, The Voice of Turkey, Radio New Zealand International, and Radio Japan, just to name a few. You have to dig a bit deeper sometimes, but lots of great programming can still be found from public broadcasters around the world. In addition, thanks to relay stations around the world, like Isodon and WRMI in Miami, many other state broadcasters can be heard, such as Radio Japan and Deutsche Welle from Isodon, Radio Prague, Radio Slovakia International, Radio Taiwan in Spanish, and RAI Argentina via WRMI. Other stations such as Radio Tirana, Radio Ukraine International, and World Radio Network programming have been heard as well. Another tool shortwave listeners have is remote listening using a distant receiver online. This is a technology that can enable one to listen to a lot of radio stations not normally heard at one's location due to many considerations. This is a very interesting development in the last few years. I've listened to stations from time to time that were not propagating well to Canada, but were being heard in other areas. Win-win. In this case, the internet enhances shortwave listening. Religious broadcasters are another genre of broadcasting. The vast majority of these programs are Christian, from a broad spectrum of denominations. Gospel programming helped to pioneer broadcasting both domestically and internationally. The very term broadcasting was originally coined by an evangelist, who viewed radio as a way to spread the gospel, much like a farmer plants a handful of seeds with a broadcast, spreading the seeds quite far. Christian broadcasters seem to be doing as well as ever. As much as some might roll their eyes at the mention of Brother Stair or other ubiquitous evangelists, they do seem to pay the bills, so radio stations can stay on the air and broadcast other things. And I do listen to all of them from time to time. As a curious listener, I'm always interested in what they have to say. On a case-by-case basis, I may think some have very interesting things to say. Some are entertaining. Dr. Gene Scott, for instance, back in the day. I can still hear him yelling to get on the telephone, although his cigars and funny hats were lost on the radio audience. As an aside, I do find it interesting how his wife and successor, Pastor Melissa Scott, has cleaned up his classic sermons and edited out most of the P.T. Barnum aspects. As a listener, I always enjoy the maybe not-so-famous evangelists. One can hear a wide variety of styles and viewpoints, sometimes endearing, sometimes fire and brimstone, often with some unexpected musical gems. My final observation is that sometimes the boundary is blurred between politics and religion. I suppose this is not a new phenomenon. In fact, I first noticed it in 1979 on a local radio station in Buffalo. There was a fellow who late at night would rant about Jimmy Carter being a communist for giving the Panama Canal back to Panama. Perhaps it's a reflection of the polarized world we live in these days, but it's an interesting trend. Some programs, it's hard to tell if they're winning souls or campaigning for office. Christian broadcasting will always be with us, and that's a good thing for listeners, broadcasters, and radio stations. Perhaps the most exciting trend in shortwave radio is the incredible amount of new programs appearing on shortwave without either a political or religious nature. I refer to the explosion of radio programs produced by people with a passion for radio and a particular style of music. Or in the case of Voice of the Report of the Week, thoughtful discussion. These programs have always been around. For instance, Marion's Attic has been on the air on WBCQ for 25 years. But they've always been a small minority of programming, perhaps on a weekend in between other fare. But in the last few years, there's been an explosion. For a few years, WBCQ featured the Radio Angela programming block. Every night, there were a couple of programs, mostly music-oriented, from a wide variety of individuals in different countries, and playing a lot of different genres. Kudos to Bill Telford, who curated this block, as well as hosting his two terrific music programs, Uncle Bill's Melting Pot and From the Isle of Music. At the same time, a wide variety of music programs can be heard via WRMI, bringing back a whole 1980s Radio Earth vibe. On any given day, one can hear multiple music programs and genres. Later today, Sean Welsh will be speaking about his Canadian Content Radio program, which features, as the name implies, some fabulous Canadian music and his own unique sense of fun. If you poke around the WRMI schedule, you'll find music of yesteryear, progressive music, blues, classical, and good old rock and roll, and even Frederick Moe's imaginary stations. There are other stations, too, providing this kind of entertainment. Radio 292 in Germany provided some of the content for Radio Angela. It's become home to an intriguing mix of programs. WWCR, to a lesser extent, is home to Worldwide Country Radio, The Pat Boone Show, and others. These are the kinds of programs that will draw listeners to the other programming on the stations. In some ways, this is one of the more exciting times to listen. Events in Ukraine and elsewhere have also been reflected in shortwave programming. A number of countries have added programming aimed at both sides in that war. Shortwave has the ability to get around censorship and internet geo-blocking. It's been argued that there's no one to listen, that no one has shortwave radios anymore. Of course, hasn't that always been the case? Shortwave listening has always been a niche pursuit as a sort of a soft power diplomacy. All I know is that if I was in a situation where my access to information was being limited, I'd try to explore other means to get that information. I think the folks here at this conference probably have a good read on such things. I'm just a guy with a radio in southern Ontario with a curiosity about how all this stuff works. The difference is that I have a bit of a platform as editor of a column about shortwave programs. If I can put my editor's cap on for a minute, since I may never have an opportunity like this again, I'd like to throw out a few ideas. When I first started writing columns, it was on a typewriter, on paper, which then became a printed bulletin that was mailed out. All correspondence was by letter mail. Everything took a long time. The internet has sped everything up. My column is due the 11th of every month and is often in subscribers' inboxes within 2 weeks. I've sent emails to radio stations and heard back in minutes, not weeks, which is all good. If I had three magic wishes, it would be as follows. I wish radio stations and radio programs would realize how helpful we in the hobbyist community can be. I'm not the only person writing about shortwave programming. Bill Tilford has a column with NASWA. My friend Alan Rowe in the UK also does a similar column. And there is the Sesquihour fellow in the US. Each month we are writing our columns and endeavoring to be up-to-date, accurate, and interesting. If I had the legs for it, I'd jump up and down with a pair of pom-poms yelling, "Hey, over there, I can help promote your program and station." I'm sure the others I mentioned feel the same. We are a resource to get the word out to listeners when you have something coming up. I can't think of a single time I told someone from a radio program, "No, sorry, I can't mention that this month," unless it was impossible due to the nature of my deadlines and such. Over the years, I've made this offer to radio programs, who are usually delighted. I was only blown off once, which I found curious, but it never stopped me from promoting that show when I had the opportunity. Maybe it's possible that radio stations and programs just don't know about us. Maybe that's something we need to work on. Can it be possible that radio stations do not know about shortwave publications? Anyway, we're here, and have been for a long time, and we would love to help get the word out about your efforts. We can help get you more listeners, a few more anyway, with very little effort on your part. Often the material in our columns is reposted and rebroadcast in many places. I once saw my work translated into Indonesian, which was pretty interesting indeed. Well, in this internet age, many shortwave broadcasters have websites or social media accounts. These are gold mines as we strive to inform our readers about new or special programming on the air, or they can be. It's sad to come across websites that are very out of date, or social media accounts that haven't been updated in months or years. I realize radio stations and programs are stretched to the breaking point with staff and funding shortages. But again, it's very easy to update a Facebook page once a week. Each month, when I'm preparing a column, I scour websites for schedules, program information, staff pictures, and such. I check Facebook pages and Twitter as well, where I know there are accounts. It's never been easier to drive more listeners to a station. The internet doesn't have to be an enemy. We as listeners have to step up our game, too. Just like it's never been easier to get information, it's never been easier to contact stations and programs by email. I firmly believe that there are more listeners out there than many think. I think it's incumbent on listeners to contact broadcasters, even if it's just to let them know they are listening. I've been trying to practice what I preach. To be honest, it's quite rewarding. I've had some delightful exchanges with broadcasters who were appreciative of knowing that I was indeed listening and that I admired their work. Each month in my column, I try to remind readers to give this a try. And those remarks were prepared by Fred Waterer, a shortwave columnist for the Spectrum Monitor, an online publication about various aspects of radio listening. Fred's speech was on the agenda of the 2024 NASB Annual Meeting in Ontario, Canada. We end WaveScan today with folk music from São Tomé. Thanks for listening to WaveScan, the international DX program from Adventist World Radio. Researched and written in Indianapolis by Adrian Peterson and in Los Angeles by Ray Robinson. Next week, Japan, Part 1. More from the recent HFCC Shortwave Frequency Coordination Conference in Uzbekistan. WaveScan is heard weekly on KSDA in Guam, AWR relays in various locations, WRMI in Florida, WWCR in Tennessee, Voice of Hope Africa in Zambia, and IRRS Italy. Send reception reports directly to the station you're listening to. Reports for KSDA and other AWR sites should go to qsl@awr.org. Other correspondence, not reception reports, can be sent to wavescan@yahoo.com. I'm Jeff White at WRMI Shortwave in Okeechobee, Florida. Till next week, good listening, everyone. Na 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 na